Good afternoon, Jim.
Hi, Mark.
Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm a longtime Blogging Heads regular, but I'm now affiliated with the Roosevelt Institute, and you're here in my office at the Roosevelt Institute in Washington D.C.
Okay, and I'm Jim Pinkerton, Fox News contributor. Still, I think technically on the masthead of the New America Foundation.
I am too technically on the masthead of the New.
All right, okay.
Never let that drop at all costs.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a valuable and a great chance to get to know people like you.
It has been fun. Anyway, I'm here speaking here from Pinkerton Supreme Headquarters in Arlington, Virginia.
Okay, very good.
Today is Tuesday, so. The big news is to you?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I have trouble figuring out whether there's actually news in Haley Barbour not running for president or not. Part of me looks at it and says, you know, this isn't a guy I really believed could win the nomination, and certainly I don't think could really win the presidency. So then how could him not running have that dramatic an effect, you know?
Yeah, I must say that it's funny to reflect that, you know, a day or two ago, the news was Haley's at 1% and is not going anywhere and blah, blah, blah. And now that he's out, you know, now they're saying, oh, gosh, this changes everything. You know, all his legions of supporters will be scattered who knows where and so on. So if I weren't so trusting, I would think that maybe this was a liberal media narrative to reinforce the idea that the existing Republican field is a bunch of dwarfs who couldn't possibly beat Obama, but that would just be I would only say that if I were paranoid.
It's an interesting thing. I mean, I guess the way it's told is that there were a group of sort of elite establishment figures who were signed up to, you know, Team Barbour, and frankly, they're all people that I don't think I've even heard of. You probably know them better than I do, but you know, it wasn't. You know, they're sort of people that it seems to me we're told are elite figures, and now they're free, and they'll either wind up at, you know, with Romney, or they'll wind up with Pawlenty or something else.
Yeah, I must say, though, that you're right. They probably are better known on K Street than in Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina. But I will just say this. I think Haley would have made a good president. I mean, a great president, even. I think mm-hmm. he's a skilled guy, a very competent executive. Had good on issues, was the first to really say that, you know, to Republicans that perhaps the Afghanistan thing wasn't working out well. I can remember him saying that back in 2008 when Bush 43 was still president. Willing to say we need to take a look at defense as well, and not just take a look, but more than take a look. You know, I think that almost anybody would agree that you're not going to get very far, you know, in terms of deficit reduction or cutting spending if you can't look at everything, and certainly defense, you know, which is probably about 1/6 of the federal budget, probably, or maybe more like 1/5.
More than that, I think.
Yeah, probably more like 1/5. If you can't cut that, then you're not going to get all the cuts you need out of everything else. So, anyway,
Especially if revenues are off limits, obviously.
Right.
If you're just.
Right. So I think Haley will wind up on somebody else's campaign or running some sort of, you know, think tank or something. He will be a major.
Well, He has another couple of years as governor, right?
His term ends at the end of this year. He was elected in 2005. No, correction. No, I take that back. The end of this year. End of this year being 2011. Okay. Yeah, time flies.
What's wrong with the liberal media narrative that it's a bunch of dwarves? You know, I mean, I'm from a party that most years has a bunch of dwarves, so you know, it's not necessarily an insult.
No, it's not necessarily an insult.
I was alive and conscious in 1988. You know,
I think the phrase dwarves for our younger viewers goes back to 1988 when it was the seven dwarves, including Michael Dukakis, who at least for a while in the spring and summer of 1988 was as many as 17 points ahead. So you know, he wasn't that dwarfish at least then. You know, I think that look, there's one President Obama president, and then there's 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, you know, who knows exactly how many Republican nominees, and so just simply fratricide says, or just dividing up the available Republican mind share among you know, probably six or seven sort of likely serious candidates, and it inherently means that they're dividing each other up and look kind of small by comparison.
Well, that doesn't seem right, Jim. That doesn't seem right, because if you think back to like 1996, there was Bob Dole at this very, you know, very high level, figure of enormous stature, had, you know, nationally known, Senate Majority Leader, absolutely assumed to be the nominee, had all the support. And then there were a bunch of figures who were challenging him in interesting ways. Why don't we have, and that's normally the pattern of a Republican race. There's someone, and then there's a few people trying to beat that someone. Why is this race so different?
Well,
why does this race at the moment seem to be so different?
Right, let's go back to 96. I mean, Dole, I grant you, Dole was, well, let's go back. So this time in the 96 cycle meant we were at April of 95, right, to keep the parallelism here.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I'll tell you right now, in April of 95, the hot figure in the Republican Party was Gingrich. He was the one who made the speech to the nation somewhere, I can't remember exactly when it was, in April, where he held up a computer chip and stuff and seemed like the wave of the future and the inevitable, you know.
The de facto prime minister. I was trying to find that phrase the other day. I know he was called that at some point. It's like, you know, people were suggesting that Clinton had almost moved to like that honorary head of state role, and Gingrich was the head of government.
Clinton was still saying, "Hey, look, guys, I'm relevant. Don't forget me." So in April of '95, it was totally Gingrich. Now, somewhere in the course of '95, Gingrich, you know, faded, self-destructed, whatever you want to say. And then Dole. So Dole was a, you know, looked obviously Dole.
But,
you know, had been in the Senate for 25
years. But let's
go
back. I don't remember Gingrich being considered likely to run for president at that time.
Oh, I do.
Maybe I'm just missing.
You probably weren't as plugged into the Republican tom-toms as I was. I mean, it was not a major factor. he never ran. But let me tell you something about Dole.
Yeah.
Dole had all that stature going for him. Had been, you know, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, and you know, all the things you said earlier, and so on. But then he lost New Hampshire, if you remember.
Right.
I mean, it was no sin. I mean, he was not such an obvious juggernaut that Pat Buchanan, you know, never been elected to anything, except maybe, you know, student council or something, knocked him off in New Hampshire. Now, Dole kind of, you know, and Steve Forbes is in there, too. I mean, Steve Forbes probably falls in the category of the interesting guy who, you know, I guess never won anything. He might have won something, but anyway, spent a lot of money and never won a thing. So it's not as clear to me that Dole was on some inevitable progression to the nomination in 96. And
no, I'm not saying that he necessarily couldn't have been brought down. But what you were saying is because there's a bunch of candidates, they naturally seem small because they're kind of dividing, you know, all the attention.
Right.
And I think in 96, you know, Dole was getting all the attention, and then there were these other, or 95 as you're in the run up to it, and then there's a contest for who's going to actually kill the king, because there were definitely problems with Dole as a candidate for the right. I mean, he was from a very different era in American politics in many ways.
He absolutely was, and I think that's where C. Forbes came from to kind of reclaim the sort of supply sider ethos and so on.
I remember when Dole gave, I was working in the Senate then, Dole gave this speech up on the 8th floor of the Hart Building, I guess when he was resigning from the Senate, and I went up there and watched it, and it was this, you know, he had a beautiful, plain-spoken, I thought at the time that he actually had one of the sort of very distinctive rhetorical gifts as an American politician, very, very plain prose style that was actually, I remember finding it a very moving speech, and you know, thinking about just, you know, that guy had given a lot of energy and passion to you know, trying to govern the country in the way that he thought right, and I've always thought quite an admirable guy.
Well, and the point's been made.
Which is exactly why he was the wrong for the Republican Party.
Well, it's also been...
And I'm about to endorse Mitch Daniels, so we'll bring him down, too.
All right, we'll talk with him, speaking of plain-spoken Midwesterners. The point has been made retrospectively that if Saving Private Ryan, the Steven Spielberg movie about D-Day, had come out, you know, two or three years before. It came out, I think, in 98, and if it had come out in time for the 96 election, bringing on, I think, an additional wave and surge of World War II nostalgia and a completely, you know, the Tom Brokaw Greatest Generation books and so on. If that had happened a little bit sooner, Dole might well have won the White House in 96. Who knows?
That's an interesting theory. Well, obviously, then you create that as the liberal narrative, delayed the film to, you know, keep it out of the cycle. You know, Steven Spielberg knows what he's doing.
I knew it. Finally, a confession.
And if Apocalypse Now had come out in 2008, John McCain would be president.
I think back to Apocalypse Now. I'm not sure that was quite the hero treatment of. Well, anyway,
no, it wasn't. I was just joking. But so some of the other candidates, I mean, I guess there are two questions that I, you know, want to ask people like you who are better plugged in. Is one, I mean, obviously there is some kind of Republican establishment, and to the extent that the Republican establishment exists, it seems to be mostly behind Romney. And it strikes me when I look at any of the polls that have come out that, you know, Mitt Romney just doesn't connect with people very well. I mean, he's just, you know, he was at 11% in the poll last week that had mostly imaginary candidates on top, you know, Trump and Palin and Huckabee. I mean, people who are generally thought to be not running, and maybe you can correct my view about that. You know, but even when you take out the imaginary candidates, Romney's still barely gets to 20%. That's not Dole in 96. And it seems to me, I don't know if there, if it, like, and Romney's a terrible candidate for Iowa. So at some point, it seems to me, doesn't the establishment say, maybe we're better off with Tim Pawlenty? And how does the establishment, you know, I mean, we on the far outside of it see, you know, imagine there's some room out there, and I don't even know what it is. What is the establishment that would allow you to make a shift from Romney to Pawlenty or Romney to Daniels or whatever?
Right. Well, of course, everybody knows the Democratic establishment consists of John Podesta and Robert Strauss and, you know, Bill Clinton. Right. They sit around and make all the big decisions, like making Hillary Clinton.
Is Robert Strauss still alive?
I think he is, but I mean, I was joking about him. But if the Democratic establishment existed, right, Hillary would be the president now, right?
Right. Well, I think one of the big things that we've learned since the election is the degree of quiet, including Harry Reid, of course, the degree of quiet establishment support that Obama actually had.
You're saying in the campaign?
In the campaign. Right. I think that is the... I mean, I guess that's probably, to me, that was one of the most interesting pieces of news out of that, Halperin book.
Halperin and Hyman, Mark, I can remember, just to give you a plug, I can remember you saying all along you thought that Obama was way stronger than people thought. I mean, I think
I'm not the establishment.
I know you're not the establishment, but this would actually raise a new confusing issue if there were actually two establishments. They both thought they were in charge, right? Bill and Hillary Clinton were sitting around thinking we're the establishment. So, obviously, you, Hillary, it's your turn next to be president. And then, meanwhile, there's another establishment somewhere. That's sort of like, if you remember the trust, this sort of notional thing the Soviets had in the 20s, where they had like a fake Soviet party that people could spy on, and that we could go to the West and say, here's the way in, and so on. It was a total hoax. Maybe there's a parallel there. Who knows? Maybe that's where they got the idea. But back to the Republican establishment. I agree that what was sort of passed for the Republican establishment, and bearing in mind that, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, K Street and, you know, I don't think the Koch brothers, for example, see themselves as part of this. I think that, you know, undoubtedly they're allied on a fair number of issues, but by no means all. What passes for the Republican establishment was probably divided between Romney and Haley Barbour. And now they're calculating to themselves, look, our natural kind of corporatist instincts take us to Romney. On the other hand, as Mark Schmidt pointed out, you know, Romney can't seem to get above 11% in any poll, and everybody thinks he's kind of dead meat, not only over the Mormon thing, which, you know, was obviously an issue in 08, but the sort of the whole new issue of the sort of congruence, if not identicalness, between, you know, Romneycare and Obamacare. The sort of bottom has sort of fallen out of that particular vision of healthcare, sort of the guaranteed mandate going back to the 90s mm-hmm. with the Heritage Foundation. That was sort of the standard Republican wisdom ten years ago, even 5 years ago. And now it's in the wake of the Tea Party, it's sort of evaporated as and something. And so, you know, Romney, I mean, I think that the conventional wisdom in Republican circles is Romney will have to make a completely abject apology for Romney care to get through the Republican primaries. Now, some people say he's perfectly capable of doing what it takes or saying whatever it takes, but he hasn't yet. This might be this might be the place where he stands on principle. Who knows?
Well, I mean, he's sort of he's not standing on principle of saying like this was a really great thing. It's not like he's a principled individual. He's just avoiding that apology. Because I think that's a fairly dramatic. I don't know how you get around being the guy who apologizes. That doesn't solve your problem. That's kind of like the whole. There was a whole question of like whether Hillary Clinton would apologize for her vote on Iraq.
Right.
And I always thought that's actually. If I was advising Hillary Clinton, I wouldn't. I don't think it was the right vote. I don't see how you apologize. You open up a whole kettle of worms sometimes when you apologize for something. It's judgment you exercise. So Romney's obviously been trying to dodge around it and pretend that there are bigger differences between the two than there really are, and circumstances are different, whatever, or that he really was ever for was just states being able to do whatever they wanted. Certainly didn't mean it to be a federal mandate, even though, yes, I think you and I both saw him speak at New America Foundation and talk about how great this plan was.
He was very convincing at the time.
And the point wasn't just like it's okay for Massachusetts, but not everybody else. The point was, this is the model for the nation. So, it'll be hard for him to do, but I'm not sure I don't know how you do that kind of apology.
I don't either, which is why the case for establishment may be reaching around for somebody else. But I should say, by the way, that I'm not, full disclosure, I worked for Huckabee in 08, and I am a fan. No kind of sense of whether he's going to run again or not. I realize sort of the in trade, if they're doing it for Republican nominees, they probably have him kind of low right now in terms of actual prospect of running. But he is ahead pretty steadily ahead in Iowa, in South Carolina, at least even on the national Republican polls, with that new phenom Donald Trump seeming to probably be as likely as anybody to be ahead. And I'm not even sure Trump won't wind up running. I mean, I've never met the man in my life.
I'm sure he won't. I've always said, the quickest you're fired is being the guy who has to go to Donald Trump and say, sir, you actually have to fill out this financial disclosure form. And all that baloney that you've been spouting about how much money you have is going to suddenly go out the window.
Well, I just wouldn't be too sure. Trump, has bled a lot on the birth certificate issue and so on like that, and why would he go through that if he didn't really mean it? And then if he really did mean it, then maybe he just continues to run.
Maybe you just continue to run because he started an attention getting gambit that succeeded at getting him attention, and it's like the experiment with the monkeys where they give them the button to push for cocaine and they just do nothing but push the button all the time. Maybe you'll keep pushing the button all the way into the election. But
a flattering analogy.
Donald Trump and attention definitely seems like in the same category as the monkeys with the cocaine. I'm just an incredibly unserious person. It's just staggering the carelessness with which he approaches the whole thing, including the birth certificate issue. But I guess it's interesting. I mean, Huckabee could get a later start than I mean, certainly at a certain point, most candidates need to be sending the signal that they're running. But Huckabee can presumably get a bit of a later start.
I think he can. I think he could really. This will sound heretical. I think he could wait towards the end of the year. I think he's got the name ID. He's got the visibility. He's got the platform. And he's got the support. But again, I He's certainly getting pressure from a lot of places to run, to decide, whatever. And in the meantime, I grant you that Mitch Daniels or somebody else is probably thinking about getting in or reconsidering their decision not to get in. Somebody we haven't even thought about, some other billionaire. Who knows? So, but meanwhile, I mean, of course, one thing that's attracting all these Republicans into the field is the perception there's something wrong with Obama. So let's talk about him for a second here and how he's doing circa spring 2011.
Yeah, I'm not quite where I was on Obama in 2007. I'm not, I've always been a pretty big Obama apologist. But especially, I'm sort of actually feeling like I miss Rahm Emanuel a little bit because... Wow. There's a little bit of a softness, I think, in the way the administration has been approaching, I think, particularly things like the Ryan budget plan. I mean, I thought the speech was fine. I thought the speech was great. But, this is really your moment. I felt the Republicans had been sort of dodging. One reason for the election was, spending cuts, budget balances appealing to people in general. It's kind of a metaphor for an economy that's in the sort of shape that people expect it to be. As an abstract matter, it's always appealing. And then when you really put it on the table, especially when it's not accompanied by revenue increases from the wealthiest, it's not as appealing to people. So everything was set up for the moment when, yes, the Republicans had to put something on the table. And what they put on the table was an incredibly ripe target. And it will be for a long time.
You mean the Ryan plan?
I mean the Ryan plan. But I felt like there isn't that kind of killer instinct there in the White House about this is the moment where you really define what this conflict is about. I think there's a tendency. I think I'm feeling like the White House has kind of almost given up on the ability to actually define the terms of the conflict. So that it's sort of like, okay, we're going to talk about deficit reduction. Here's our plan on deficit reduction, or whatever. Instead of I think part of the story is maybe it's just a very different communications environment, and maybe you can't really fight it. Although Obama fought it and got around it in the campaign, but certainly George Bush consistently defined what he wanted us to be arguing about. Not what he wanted, not just what he wanted the Republican and White House position to be, but what it was we were talking about. If he wanted to talk about national security, we were going to talk about national security. And I don't mean that that's not a truth or claim or anything like that. But consistent ability to define what the conflict in terms of debate were that I think this administration has really really lost sight of. And maybe you need a little time after the election to just sort of get back to a place where you can do that. But I'm not even seeing that's what Rahm Emanuel did. And I don't think that's what a Bill Daley does. Maybe I'm personalizing it too much around individual White House chiefs of staff. But I'm just not feeling that energy.
That's interesting because, the conventional wisdom, even heard on Blogging Heads, I think, three or four months ago was, that Daley will be an improvement, a sort of a corporate improvement over Emanuel, and that Daley is no progressive. I think that's fair to say. But the thought was that he would run the place better and so on. But maybe
I don't work there, so maybe obviously there were things that happened, like everybody on the economic team fighting with each other, and all the stuff that's kind of coming out in some of the stories about Peter Orszag, that we're getting a better sense of what was happening there. That sometimes you need a. Sometimes you need a boss who comes in and says, "That's it. I'm not putting up with everyone undermining each other." And I think that had a lot to you're never going to prevent that in the White House. But the whole culture of Obama was so much the no drama Obama culture of the campaign that maybe they couldn't absorb that. And maybe I don't think Rahm's somebody who reduces the level. You know how some people in an office or whatever, some people increase the level of conflict and drama, and some people reduce it. I would guess that Daley's more like a reducer and Rahm is more like a increaser of conflict. And that's just an organizational question that, maybe Daley's far better on that front. But in kind of the gut instinct about how you present yourself to the country, I'm not really feeling it right now coming from the White House, even though, I think the default is you can always give a great speech.
Well, that's interesting because
That doesn't do very much anymore.
I think we're talking about that same April 13th speech. The one where he said, you know, Paul Ryan's Path to Prosperity plan would, quote, end Medicare as we know it. I actually thought, and maybe, you know, it's just interesting, I agree it was an effective speech. And I wrote a piece for, of all places, Fox News, saying, look, we've seen this before, folks, back in 1948, when Harry Truman was confronting a Republican-controlled Congress that was sort of dedicated to, you know, repealing the New Deal to the extent that they could, having won in 46, and then having spent 1947 passing Taft-Hartley and so on. A lot of these bills that Truman vetoed, some of which, like Taft-Hartley, were overridden, some of which, like a tax cut, were not overridden. And Truman confronting the then Republican nominee Tom Dewey, the two-term governor of New York, who was sort of a moderate, thoughtful, inoffensive, and kind of a national hero, sort of a little bit of a Giuliani in terms of being a racket-busting district
prosecutor,
attorney. Putting you know Lucky Luciano in jail and you know and so on. That Truman realizing that the Republicans in Congress made a much more appealing target from a Democratic partisan, you know, fire-breathing point of view. Sort of ignored Dewey all through 1948 and rained fire
and focused
down
on the Congress,
on
right?
Do nothing, unquote, 80th Congress.
Right.
And so I sort of thought that's what Obama was doing with the 112th Congress, at least the Republican half of it. And so it is interesting to think now, 2 weeks later, Obama's polls are down somewhat, I think, but it seems to me that he has kind of solidified the Democratic message. Certainly the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is going full bore now against Republicans in Congress. Now, maybe the White House has kind of lost that thread, even if Chris Van Hollen of the DCCC has now doing his best to clearly show, you know, senior citizens and everyone else the choice they face come a year from November.
Right. I mean, maybe it's something the White House does. I mean, it feels like it was almost like a one-off to me, but maybe that's right. Maybe it's something that the White House doesn't really have to do. I mean, if you really did have, if you had a level of anger and hostility at town hall meetings that was even a fraction of what you had, you know, in the healthcare summer nightmare, you might really change the dynamic at this point, so that you start to have a lot, the bigger Republican victory, the more you have, you know, first termers who are in district that Obama won, who are extremely vulnerable, and you know, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, to push those votes through, you know, straight party line votes, making people take a vote that's potentially going to define their career. I'll tell you, Democrats wouldn't do that. Fresh Democrats would not have. But let themselves get put in that position. So, you know.
Well, I mean, I think plenty of them did, though, right? In 08. I mean, plenty of them did intend. I mean, plenty of Democrats, you know, I forgot how many Democrats voted against Obamacare in the end.
A lot of freshmen got permission to, you know, you needed permission.
Permission.
It wasn't like vote of conscience, but a lot, and they lost, too. I mean, it didn't help them at all to have voted against Obamacare. It'll be different. This will be interesting because whether you voted for Obamacare or not, or voted for the ACA, I'll try to be a little disciplined in my language, whether you voted for that or not, it was a fact. It defined the administration. It defined the Democratic Congress. Nobody really cared whether you, Jason Altmaier in Pennsylvania, whatever, cast your vote against it. It really didn't matter. This is a little different because, I mean, the Ryan plan is just going to be sort of a vague thing that's out there that won't really become law it's hard for people to understand what that actually is.
Right, and that's, I think that's a good news for Republicans. You know, as somebody who, in my case, who sort of warned them, said, look, this is kind of stark and you know, people are a lot more concerned about their health and welfare and well-being and medical safety in the next 5 or 10 years more than they are, you know, the fiscal situation of the country in 40 years. Saw on the news this morning that this company called Cytos in Switzerland is now saying that they might have a vaccine for Alzheimer's. Now, again, who knows, years away from any kind of real test on that, but nonetheless, a reminder, if we look back to our medical history, not our healthcare history, but our medical history, so every now and then somebody comes up with a cure for smallpox or polio or scarlet fever or whooping cough or whatever it is, and you save money not by managing the care better, but by actually sort of eliminating the disease. And, to think that we're fighting over Medicare cuts in, 2040 or 2050, when for all we know, by then, medical care will advance to the point where people can work until they're 80, and happily so, because they're healthy and they don't have Alzheimer's or whatever else, does remind one of the danger of trying to make current day votes based on fiscal projections decades ahead.
Right, absolutely. I mean, somebody was interviewing me the other day and asking about, and they told me what they were going to ask me about, so I just did a little research before I started asking about, what was healthcare for, what did seniors have before there was Medicare? And the answer was, it's really hard to create an insurance market for people over 65. The reason the insurance market works for people under 65 is, you have that boundary on it so that you've got some people who are going to be healthy and some people who aren't. There really wasn't much. You could, in theory, buy health insurance, or you could just pay as you went. But, the problem was there really wasn't going to be anything that was going to bankrupt you anyway.
Right. I mean, think about what the
you weren't going to get a transplant, right. I suppose there was dialysis would be a huge cost for a very long period of life. But, it just wasn't – the world of medicine – I guess my point was that the world of medicine has changed a lot more since 1964 than simply the presence or absence of Medicare.
And
it will change in other very dramatic ways as well. I mean, one way or another, even something like a vaccine for Alzheimer's would be enormous and would obviously be a cost reducer, but a lot of other things are going to be cost increasers, and especially as, life expectancy is going to increase. But we have ways to there are ways to deal with those medical costs. The debate is whether the Ryan plan, by just doing it in an insurance market and clamping down on insurance as aggressively, as tightly as possible, so that people are making all those choices themselves, is the right way to do that. I mean, especially when we're talking about a lot of costs that come at the very end of life when people aren't actually even capable of being rational consumers, if they ever were capable of being rational healthcare consumers.
Right. I mean, Kenneth Arrow won a Nobel Prize in part for arguing back in 1963 that people, the moment of being sick is so, obviously traumatic and difficult, assuming you're even conscious, that you're not in a really good position to bargain with your doctor and so on. I mean, you can bargain over aspirin tablets at Walmart versus Costco, and you can bargain over, sort of basics of health insurance. But when it's something really serious that could kill you or a loved one, it's hard to negotiate.
Or if you're 95 and partially comatose, there's a lot.
So therefore, the irony is that although the Ryan Care, Ryan Path to Prosperity Act plan, and Obamacare, or the American Affordable Care Act, if you prefer, are seen as much different. I mean, the Republicans say that Obamacare is distant bureaucrats, and Democrats say that the seniors are being thrown to the wolves. The reality is they've sort of both wind up with an insurance company, whether public or private, kind of running things for them. I mean, 88% of all the healthcare in this country is paid for by a third party. So you either, if you had your choice of 5 or 10 or 50 insurance plans under the Ryan plan, the way members of Congress do, you're still ultimately on the phone with some, or your doctor is, with somebody on the other end of the line saying, can I get an approval for this treatment, or can I get reimbursed for that, and so on. And so it becomes actually kind of weirdly similar, I think, between the two.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And whatever you do, it's going to be, to make it work, it has to be so tightly regulated that at a certain point you sort of say, why not just make this a public function, which is, always one of the arguments for single payer. Obviously, I think you can manage something that's halfway, certainly in the working age health insurance market.
Back to President Obama. How else do you judge? I mean, we talked about that speech. How else do you think he's doing after two plus years now in office?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of it still has to do with healthcare. I mean, if healthcare works and holds together, and is able to be implemented, and we move forward, it's a presidency of significant achievement, along with financial reform, a lot of actually I think good stuff that did happen in the stimulus, a lot of low level. I actually think the education reform approaches that he's taken have been terrific, and they've really just put a lot of energy around underneath the good things that were already beginning to happen at state and local level. So I think those are all all basically positives. Like civil liberties, basically a disaster. Everything. I'm doing a book review now of five or six books about Obama, and you can line them up from this book called The Mendacity of Hope by Roger Hodge, which is sort of the liberal view that we were absolutely utterly conned, to something like Eric Alterman's Kabuki Democracy or Jonathan Alter's book, which was about the first year but was just reissued with an epilogue about the second, which is just much more of an understanding that it is a very tough context. Everything sort of has an explanation because it's a very tough context to govern in. Where in that range is the truth. I think you can look at the civil liberties and say, they just got stuck on Gitmo. Yeah, everybody thinks, George Bush thought Gitmo should close, but somehow it just became impossible to do it. And that's not an acceptable answer, really, because it's really an outrageous extra-legal system. But I don't, it's not like if the president said to me, come back in 10 days with a memo on how we're going to pull this off, I'm not sure I'd know how to do it in a way that I can say, yes, we can maneuver through the politics, as well as figure out what to do with all these individuals who are there. So, it's just a question of where do you think the context matters? But there's no question it's kind of a disappointing in its ability to really confront what's going on in the economy. And I think that maybe as the business cycle picks up, maybe we sort of get a little bit lucky. I mean, this is not going to be the recovery of 1984. By any means, but maybe that sort of okay. Then that question of how did we adequately deal with the recession becomes less immediate. But then you really face the question of what really is our economy going to be able to do? What kind of jobs are we going to create? What element of long-term unemployment, inequality, stagnation of wages really has to do with the structure of jobs? And what tools do we have to do something about it?
Do you think Jeffrey Immelt is a positive or a negative on this score? Jobs advisor, whatever.
I don't know whether he's a positive or a negative. I mean, I think there are, I think that there are people other than Immelt who think about this I don't have a view about Immelt particularly. Immelt was doing two things. One, that appointment was doing two things. One, it was obviously, here is a smart and creative guy who understands a lot of different aspects of the economy. And two, it was showing, I, Barack Obama, am now friendlier to business than you thought I was. Even though, as far as I'm concerned, Barack Obama saved capitalism, and everybody ought to just bow down about that. But particularly people on Wall Street. Obviously, that's not the perception.
I'm not sure he saved. I think he saved Goldman Sachs. I'm not sure he saved capitalism.
Well, he certainly saved Goldman Sachs. I think it's fair to say that he saved the financial sector and he saved the auto sector. And that's a couple big sectors. And if both of those kind of if you have a complete financial meltdown, and the auto industry completely collapses, I'm not sure what else you have left. He didn't say, it's not quite the same saving capitalism. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Franklin Roosevelt absolutely saved capitalism. And it's not the same kind of thing, partly because it's not like you have an alternative waiting in the wings, which to a greater degree there was at the time of FDR.
Yeah. I completely agree with you on Roosevelt back in 1933. But then the problem was if we hadn't had Roosevelt, we would have gotten, fascism or communism or Huey Longism or you know,
right.
something.
Right.
Now
that's what I mean by something waiting in the wings.
I think probably I'm not sure we're better off for having Goldman Sachs having been saved, frankly. And as for the auto industry, that's you know it was you're talking about the Detroit companies. I mean, there's plenty of autos not being made in Detroit, and so
right.
on. So
right.
I think that
right.
you know in 2009 had Wall Street crash, and I'm not saying that's a good idea. I think what's clear is that the Obama administration and the Bush administration, which was, they were, which to me I think the story, and I probably you probably would agree with this, the story of Hank Paulson to Tim Geithner is a story of continuity, not you know discontinuity.
Absolutely.
Nobody back then thought about well, how do we claw back these profits?
Right.
If these
right.
companies, if Goldman Sachs is now a utility, if the government now saved it, you know, saved as you know right. what. Then why isn't Lloyd Blankfein getting a GS-17
right.
salary,
right.
As opposed to $100 million a year or whatever, and plus
right.
billions more he'll take out when he retires.
Right, and I think the interesting question is whether you know, I mean, certainly to some people on the left, the continuity of Hank Paulson to Tim Geithner, that's the indictment in a nutshell. You know, I mean, if you read this, you know, something like the Roger Hodge bookers or even Paul Krugman and some others. I mean, that's all you need to say. Is the continuity between those. On the other hand, there was a lot of value in continuity at that moment. And there weren't a lot of people, you know, you couldn't put somebody, the universe of people that you could make Treasury Secretary was very, very small. Given the situation we were in, there was no time for learning on the job. I mean, Volcker was a possibility. I suppose Summers was a possibility, and Geithner was a possibility. I don't know how many. I don't know who else really would be in that universe. Of those, only Volcker potentially gives you something. You know, much more. Kind of aggressive stance.
Yeah, no, I'm a fan of Volcker, and I think he's been exactly right on
yeah.
all this. And it's telling that he's been sort of, I guess, pushed out of the Obama.
He really has been sidelined. So that that's another element of it. The sort of the limitations they've placed on themselves in about the scope of debate about the economy.
Let's talk about trade too, because I think that's. I was struck by David Stockman's article in the New York Times, I think on Sunday, where he just hit a sort of a throwaway line, but I mean it wasn't. Meant to be thrown away. It was just sort of in there in passing. That you know, look, outsourcing quote disemboweled the economy.
Right.
I think it's going to be very hard to restore you know heartland wages as long as there's China right there to all those factories to go to. I don't think
right.
you can redistribute income in this country very well.
Absolutely not. But this is a big. I mean, I don't think this is just an Obama problem. It's not a problem that there's an instant solution to. I mean, I think there's really a tendency to sort of blame the White House. I mean, I'm not absolving the White House of blame because the range of people they're listening to and the ways they're thinking about the economy should be broader. But outsourcing. Globalization, the changing patterns of there's a fabulous paper by the economist Michael Spence about the whole structure of the workforce, the fact that you know where there's economic growth, it's in non-tradable industries, or where there's job growth, you know that's a huge challenge that we don't I don't know people who have a lot of good answers. They have some things they'd want to try. There are ways you want to think about investment, but there's not. You know, there's not a super persuasive answer, and unless you have a way to explain to people what they're going through and how it can change, and how we can have a different kind of how we can get back to having more of a middle class, a country where there's more room for the middle class to grow and people to move into the middle class, then I think you've got a very tough political problem as you move into a more prosperous period. A problem we didn't that Reagan didn't have in 1984.
I completely agree. You know, one thing I did to sort of help give myself some context for the Obama presidency, you know, since I wasn't being invited to brief anybody on anything in the new administration, was I went back and
neither was I.
Okay, well,
so don't worry.
Well, in any case, Richard Hofstadter's book, *The Age of Reform*, which came out in like 1956 or so, and.
Right.
One thing that just jumps out at you as he talks about sort of the post-Civil War era and the Gilded Age and so on is the continuity. You know, like it didn't really matter whether it was Chester Arthur, well, actually, he was a little bit of a maverick, but your standard Republican, you know, of the era, Benjamin Harrison, Ulysses S. Grant, you know, Ruther Hayes, or Cleveland, President, the Democrat, because they're all kind of, you know, hard money, pro-railroad presidents who basically had sort of the same view of things, with a few exceptions here and there, like, you know, the Pendleton Act, which, you know, happened under I guess President Arthur, if I have that right, who was sort of an accidental president, it was just a guarantee that the railroads would control the legislatures and both state and federal, and so, you know, whoever the president was going to be a tool of, and there's much to be said for industrialization. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a muckraker's delight when you have sort of an industrial policy to build something like railroads in terms of scandals and so on, but on the other hand, you get a lot of railroads. Today, and I certainly agree, we've had decades of complete continuity on this. It's sort of a Wall Street delight, as in how do we further the speculative ambitions of financialists, and it seems completely bipartisan, and having a completely predictable result on the country as a whole.
Right. And I think it's important to that's, you know, that's one way that's I think works. There's definitely a left critique as well about the degree to which the president is just an instrument of this long term power structure, and really a reminder that the phrase I always use is that, you know, the political system. I don't have any illusions about complete equality in the political sphere, but I think you want the political system not to reinforce economic inequality all the time. And we definitely have a system where, you know, unprecedented economic inequality, as in the Gilded Age, is continually reinforced in the political sphere. And I think the important part is there's a lot to that power that's not just campaign contributions. Although, you know, as the president is now going to be going out and raising, you know, $1 billion, not in $35 contributions on the internet, you know, it very acutely is going to be campaign contributions. And at the same time, the House Republicans are out there on K Street with their, you know, we're in power now, here's what you have to pay for, you know, to buy yourself a place on the House Financial Services Committee or whatever. That is a big part of it, but it's not the only part of it, and not the only way that power is structured.
By the way, speaking, I agree with you on that too. Notice though that this is these last couple the 08 election and I guess the one upcoming, you never hear the press talking about how the Republicans are trying to buy the White House. Every other election, whether it was true or not, they would say the Republicans and all their giant corporate friends are going to buy the White House and spend all his money and so on. Isn't it terrible that Bush 43 is skipping the campaign finance rules and so on? And now, just stone silence when Obama is going to... I mean, again, you mentioned the billion-dollar phrase. That's a phrase that I think emerged somewhere from the Obama, you know, campaign apparatus, $1 billion. And, you know, I think any Republican, even Mitt Romney, will be lucky to have $100 million, you know, at least for the, you know, and so the idea that Obama will be outspending the the Democrat Party of the Working Man will be outspending the Republicans, you know, who knows by what factor, it is kind of amusing how, you know, this is not a flaw of the left. This is sort of a flaw of sort of the establishment media that I think sort of in some of those authors you mentioned, those books you're reviewing, I think fall in that category. Obama can do no wrong from almost not even an ideological point of view, but from sort of a power worshipping point of view.
Right. Well, I mean, that's, I think, always a very, very, and I've done a lot of stuff on campaign finance reform issues. It's always a super complicated. It's the question of how much do you want your candidates to unilaterally disarm. You know, I mean, the only one who ever really did it was Russ Feingold, not in this past race, but in the one before, where he really limited himself, and then he needed like an emergency infusion from I may have been a little bit not even really known at the time from the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, because he got, you know, that doesn't work. I mean, so I'm kind of happy as a you know, the part of me that's a Democrat and an Obama supporter, I like the fact that they can play that game, because I don't, you know, I don't want them to be shut out on account of money. Only obviously it's much better when that money is in fact coming from smaller donors, and particularly when, I mean, a lot of Obama money in 08 didn't, you know, came from people who gave a lot of time. So if you add them up, they turn out to be pretty much bigger donors. But at least that, you know, they were in the business of asking smaller donors. They were engaged with smaller donors, and it wasn't just, you know, I remember hearing I was out in Arizona once, and Janet Napolitano talking about the campaign finance law they had there, and she said, you know, when I first ran for office, it was like I had this group of people that I went and talked to for votes. You know, I talked to people on Indian reservations and so forth, and then I'd just, you know, go sit in the conference rooms of the law firms of Phoenix and ask for money. And with some reform, the people become the same. You can ask the same people for votes that you're asking for money, and vice versa. That's a little bit of what Obama was doing in 2008. I'm not happy that that's over. I mean, I think that was a great thing about 2008. I don't think it's reproducible in the same. Partly, it's just structurally not going to be. You know, you're never going to have the enthusiasm of this first time and this whole breakthrough. But it's an ugly situation, and so, you want people to be talking about alternatives all the time.
So, Mark, speaking of alternatives, since we're about to wrap up here, what's the left going to do? How's the left going to make itself felt in this regime, the current Obama presidency, whether it lasts another 2 years, another
right.
6 years? What's going to happen?
I don't know how well I speak for the left. I mean, there's a lot of people to my left, and there's a lot of people to my left who are far angrier about the administration than I am, and far more inclined and would like there to be a primary challenge, for example. I think I was on Blogging Heads, I said something about that there wouldn't likely be a primary challenge, and I got, you know, excoriated by Glenn Greenwald. There's a lot of people, you know, I think legitimately it sort of depends, a lot of it depends on what you thought would really be possible. So, you know, if you thought that, damn it, we should have a single payer health insurance, and if not, we damn well better have, you know, the public option, then you have reason to be, you're disappointed about that. I'm a little less disappointed about that because I didn't think that was that likely to happen. So that's how people play out. Part of the reality is that you know we all know the dissatisfied, we all know the elite dissatisfied left. It just doesn't show up in polls. I mean, you basically support among anything you'd consider the base, particularly because the Democratic Party base is largely African American and Hispanic and in fact lower income. It's not the same as, you know, the white liberals who thought they'd be getting something different. So it's not quite showing up. So there's I think the incentive for the White House to say, you know, get over it, join the team, you got nowhere to go, and nothing else is happening, and we are going to go as far to the, we're going to do whatever we need to do to win, and you have no leverage in this coalition. I mean, obviously nobody says that specifically, you know, says that in those terms in the White House, but, you know, it's really hard to show where you do, you know, unless you actually have a possibility of a primary challenge or some kind of, you know, maybe we won't vote like, you know, like we didn't vote for Hubert Humphrey. You know, it's really hard to get that leverage back. And I think it drives people on the left legitimately crazy. How can you have this role in helping to elect a president and certainly helping him win the primary and then really have no leverage over the White House? But you know what? We and people further to my left don't really have that leverage.
How did the Jared Bernsteins of the world fail to make their mark somehow or something?
Well, that's it. I mean, Jared Bernstein was a staffer, and he had whatever clout he had within the little battle of the economists, and I think he didn't. I think if Jared's clout or non-clout, and you know, and he's just announced he's leaving, and I don't, you know, I haven't, you know, I know him, but I haven't talked to him about his experience or heard him talk about it. I mean, I don't. I'm more thinking about like where the clout comes from outside. You know what I mean? I mean, what's the clout that Andy Stern has over the administration?
Sidney Hillman of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers from 70 years ago, who said to have the control over who the vice presidential nominee would be and so on.
Interesting.
Well,
and that's the greatest. I mean, nothing. I mean, the only thing that's remotely comparable in turn, you know, that has any possibility of clout is somebody who's actually able to deliver huge numbers of volunteers, huge numbers of voters, and money simultaneously, which would be something like SEIU. But they still don't they don't have another place to go, and until they do have another place to go, I think it's a probably a frustrating period, punctuated by things like the speech, which all my friends on the left were prepared for it to be a terrible disaster, and then we're like, well, that was a good speech, that was a great speech. The deficit, the April 13th fiscal policy speech. It gets punctuated by things like that, and then people still, I mean, a lot of people still do swoon about that. I think it's a tough, I don't know where people, this is not the liberal, the super liberal presidency that people hope for.
As Stephen Jay Gould, the late paleontologist, said, life is punctuated equilibrium. Things are going along, and then you have a big change, and then things go along well. So you have an April 13th speech, and then you have a Guantanamo, and then Libya, and then talk about. But anyway, that's another time.
Okay,
nice to catch up with you. It's been a fun hour. Best of luck in your new gig.
5 minutes. Thank you very much, Jim. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks, everybody, for watching. All right.
Okay, bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.